I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. It's easy to get discouraged when looking at events in the Middle East. I've heard heartbreaking stories about Syrian refugees fleeing for their lives as they escape that country's bloody civil war. The Egyptian military is back in power after ousting Muslim Brotherhood leader Mohamed Morsi, raising questions about what's left of the uprising of a few years ago. It seems there are almost daily reports of sectarian violence in Iraq. And while there are efforts to revive the Palestinian-Israeli peace talks, a resolution to that conflict is far from certain. Our guest, Rami Khoury, says there are reasons for some cautious optimism, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. He's the director of the Issam Faris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. He's a syndicated columnist at the Beirut-based English-language newspaper, The Daily Star. He's speaking tonight at 6:30 at Villanova University and joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. And I've only ever talked to you by telephone, so it's nice to meet you and have you here in person. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marty. My pleasure.
You know, I'm looking at an article that you wrote just a couple of weeks ago, and you begin by saying, I've been going back and forth between the United States and Arab countries for my entire life, and every time I visit the United States, I'm shocked by the mainstream public sphere's distorted and incomplete view of what's going on in our region. I just summarized some of the things that I have been observing in the Middle East. What does the American press or public get wrong?
Well, it's the main, I use the term the public sphere, because it's not just the media, it's the politicians and other public sphere elements. And really the problems are focused around the fact that the only time you hear about the Middle East, broadly speaking, is when there's violence. And much of the time, the reporting or the discussion has to do with things related to religion. So there's a massive overemphasis on religiosity, which is predominantly Islam, and a massive overemphasis on violence. Now, both of those things are there;
right.
They're part of the. But it's like if you go back to the 1950s, the only time or the 40s, the only time you heard about black people in the press was when there was a crime or somebody was a football star. But you didn't hear anything else. So you had these stereotypes that were predominantly negative. All anchored in some grain of truth, but wildly exaggerated. And the normal life, the normal patterns of life, the hundreds of millions of Arabs and Muslims and people and Turks and Iranians and Israelis and others doing normal, decent things are not conveyed in the public sphere in the United States. So that's really my problem. And also, it's very much tilted in some areas. So if you look at Arab-Israeli stuff, you're getting heavily in his pro-Israeli view. If you look at Iranian stuff, you're getting heavily a view of anti-Iranian people in the U.S. political sphere. So there's inadequacies, distortions, gaps, and exaggerations that are almost racist in their context.
Is there a country that you think that we should be looking at? As you said, there are millions of Arabs and Muslims leading regular lives. You were telling me about how wonderful Beirut is. But is there a country you think that we should look at that where we see, for instance, the roots of democracy taking hold?
Well, I think understanding Turkey and Iran is a good place to start. Those are two incredibly important countries. Neither of them are Arabs. They're both of the majority Muslim countries, ancient civilizations, countries that sort of dominated the region for centuries in past eras. And for different reasons, both of them are incredibly important and need to be understood better. Turkey, because of its transition to a relatively credible democratic system with significant economic development, and at the same time preserving Islamist values in the society as a whole. And Iran, for the incredible ability of Iran to do what it has done in so many spheres of life and development in the nuclear energy world and regional relationships. Many of the things Iran does, people in the U.S. don't like. But I think people need to understand Iran better for what it stands for and why it's able to do what it does, and to understand the difference between the regime and the people, especially during the Ahmadinejad years. Now, of course, with Rouhani, it's different.
New regime.
Yeah.
And how different do you think that is? And it looks like, the very beginnings of a thaw between Iran and the United States. Do you see that thaw? And do you see that as a germ of hope?
Oh, absolutely, yes, on both counts. There is the beginning of a thaw, and it really is happening because both the Iranians and the Americans, the American government and the Iranian government and the Iranian people in electing Rouhani, both sent important signals to the other. The critical message out of the thaw with Iran and the hopeful sentiment that there will be an agreement on the nuclear issue and the other issues that the Iranians raised. The reason that happened is critically important for Americans to grasp, and it happened because both the U.S., shorthand, the U.S. for the West and the Israelis and others, but the U.S. and the Iranian government both simultaneously made significant substantive gestures to the other. It wasn't the Americans saying, we're going to sanction you and pressure you and military threat that's on the table and expecting the Iranians to give in. They tried that for 15 years. It didn't work. And exactly the opposite happened. Every time the sanctions were ratcheted up, the Iranians built more centrifuges to spin and enrich uranium. So finally, Obama got the message. I think I really laud him. He did something very, very important, which is to understand that the old approach wasn't working. Threats and sanctions achieved exactly the opposite, which is massive expansion of Iranian nuclear enrichment, but staying below the threshold of creating a bomb. The other approach now, the U.S. has made two significant gestures, one saying to Iran, we're not going to deal with regime change, we're not going to try to change a regime. The other saying that the U.S. acknowledges Iran's right to enrich uranium with inspections and at a level that doesn't allow it to create a nuclear bomb. And the Iranians have been saying that for years, that that's what they want. And the Iranians, in return, have been making the kind of gestures that the West has wanted, which is inspections, which they've always had, but also willing to close some of the facilities, limit the amount of enrichment, limit the level of enrichment. So that's why there's been progress, because both sides moved simultaneously. It's a very powerful precedent for other things, like, for instance, the Arab-Israeli conflict and other conflicts.
This is a broad question here, but what is the view of President Obama? And, of course, he went to Egypt to make that, I guess, famous speech a couple of years ago. Some of my reading is that while the rhetoric spoke to people, there are concerns about U.S. policy, the actions of the United States in that region of the world.
Well, there are huge concerns, and really there isn't a single view of Obama. There's many different views, but most of them are disappointed in him. Right. The people who expected him to follow through on his rhetoric, which was wonderful rhetoric in his Cairo speech, they wanted him to follow through. He didn't on democratization and things like that. So a lot of people are totally disappointed with him on that, including myself. And there's other people like the Saudis and others who are disappointed because they feel that the U.S. is changing its policy and it's dropping its old allies like the Jordanians and the Saudis and others. So for different reasons, almost everybody in the Arab world is disappointed with the American leadership. But things may be changing now with this Iranian move, with the peace talks between Palestinians and Israelis, which are completely shrouded in secrecy. We don't know what's going on, but something is going on. Mm-hmm. So we have to really judge them by their results rather than by their words.
I was reading that you do not like the phrase Arab Spring. Tell us why. What's a better description of what happened a couple of years ago?
Well, I don't like the term Arab Spring. It's too simple. It's a kind of seasonal happy time moment of transition to something better, and it gives the idea that there's sort of one unified process taking place. The Arab uprisings, as I call them, or uprisings for democracy, are far more complex than can be portrayed in a phrase of two words, the Arab Spring. But the reality is that there are common grievances all across the region. Every single country has experienced some level of citizen activism, expression of grievance, or even agitation and even overthrow of regimes.
Right.
Every single regime has experienced this, but the results have been different in every one because every country is different. The legitimacy of the regime, the extent of citizen grievances, the autocratic nature, socioeconomic conditions, and therefore you have to look at the uprisings across the region in a more nuanced way. It's a little bit like the transition after the fall of the Soviet Union. Every country in the former Soviet Empire evolved in a different way, and the same thing is happening in the Arab world. But the common denominators across the region, I think, are still there, and this is a very long-term process. That's why I don't like the term spring as well. This is a process that will take years and years to play itself out, as did democratic transformation in the United States. You know, when the U.S. was created in this wonderful city and among others in 1776. It was a stirring moment of democratic freedom in which blacks had no votes or rights. Women had no votes. Immigrants, I mean, nobody had votes except white men who owned slaves and land. So, you know, the United States' transition to a democratic system included the Civil War and many internal battles. And finally, in 1965, black people got all their rights, a woman some decades earlier. So it took the United States over two centuries to reach the point today where even now you, with gay and lesbian people and other people still getting their rights. So this process of creating stable democracies evolves over centuries in most cases. We don't need centuries, but we need more than 2.5 years.
You wrote an interesting piece in the Daily Star, and I'll just pull out a couple of sentences here, and it seemed like a bit of frustration on your part about democracy, and you write, not a single credible Arab democracy, not a single Arab land where the consent of the governed actually matters. And clearly some frustration on your part that these aspirations have not been satisfied.
Well, I wrote that basically saying that my frustrations were with the modern Arab political experience of the last, say, 40, 50 years, that we haven't had a single democratic country, a single place where accountability and consent of the governed are applied, et cetera, et cetera. But I believe that the uprisings now are in certain countries, especially Tunisia and Egypt, mm-hmm. and maybe Libya soon, are registering the very first steps towards putting in place the foundational principles of democratic life. For instance, people writing their own constitutions. This is an unbelievably important step. It's happening in Tunisia. It's happening in Egypt. It's messy. It's sometimes you have a little bit of violence, but hey, you had the Civil War in this country.
Maybe
so, you know, Americans who come to the Arab world and tell us, why is your democratic process so violent? I say, well, go back and read your Civil War and then please come back and ask me that question again. So there are bouts of violence here and there, but the critical thing is that people are starting to write their own constitutions. They are tackling critical foundational issues of statehood and nationhood, the rights of citizens, the rights of minorities, the role of Islam, the role of the army, the role of religiosity and secularism, the status of woman, the central government's power versus the provinces, which is something this country is still dealing with, state rights versus federal government. So there are really a lot of hopeful signs that we are finally at the point where some Arab countries are starting to create the building blocks of democratic systems, which will need some years to come to fruition. But this is a process that has finally started. It never started ever before in the Arab world, but it is now.
We're almost up on a break here, but it sounds like you're saying be patient.
Yes, be patient, be humble, be realistic, and mainly by looking at your own experience in the Western world to see how your democratic transitions happened and to understand that this process doesn't happen at one fell swoop.
That's Rami Khoury, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's the director of the Issam Faris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University in Beirut, also a syndicated columnist for the Daily Star newspaper, which is based in Beirut as well. Speaking tonight at Villanova University at 6:30, obviously joining us today on Radio Times, talking about a very important part of the world, getting his perspective on that world and on U.S. policy as well. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Moore College of Art and Design joins you in support of WHYY and will host its open house on Sunday, October 27th from 2 to 4 p.m. for its career-focused co-ed graduate studies programs taught by professionally active faculty in an intimate campus environment on the Parkway. Alumni, faculty, and program managers will be available for you to speak with, and the galleries at Moore and the Art Shop will be open. For more on Moore College of Art and Design's October 27th open house, moore.edu. or 215-965-4016.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We are in what we hope is the next to the last day of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. I say we hope because we'll finish this campaign when we reach our final goal. We have a goal for Radio Times this morning. If you haven't made a pledge of support for whatever reason, do it now. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. So what do you get for your pledge? pledge of $10 or $20 a month, the knowledge and satisfaction that you help to pay for programs like Radio Times. We're here with you 2 hours a day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year to keep you up to speed on regional, national, and international news and trends. And we introduce you to interesting, even fascinating people and ideas. Where else do you get that kind of programming? Give us a call, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Again, our guest is Rami Khoury. He covers the Middle East as a syndicated columnist for the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, Lebanon. He's a frequent flyer between the U.S. and Lebanon and joins us on Radio Times to talk about some of the challenges and opportunities in this region of the world. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I'm quoting you a lot during this hour. Let me quote a piece you had in the New York Times this week. You began by saying the Syrian conflict has become the world's greatest proxy war since Vietnam, meaning that people have, in a sense, flocked to this country to fight their conflicts within Syria itself.
Right. You really have three levels of battles going on in Syria. There's the domestic one where the opposition is fighting the Assad regime, and that's expanded into a complex war. You have the regional battles, which include Iran, Saudi Arabia, Hezbollah, Turkey, Jordan, others. So Arabs, Iranians, Turks, Shia, Sunni, different, all kinds of regional players fighting it out. And you have the global level, which is really China and Russia versus, say, the U.S. and Western countries. So you have an extraordinary variety of parties who are directly or indirectly fighting out their battles inside Syria with a ferocious intensity, because for most of these players, the regional, the local, and the global, they see the battle in Syria as a really an existential battle. This isn't like a chess game. If they lose, they come back. This is like a gladiator's battle, that one person is going to win and the other is going to die and be gone forever from the scene. And this is how many people look at this. So this is why you get this intensity, this barbarism, this longevity, and it's so complicated to resolve.
And how does one choose sides in a proxy war when there's so many people fighting for their own individual reasons?
Well, this is what makes it so difficult now, 2 years and 8 months, 9 months after it started in March 2011. Mm-hmm. If somebody, the U.S. or the Russians or the British or the Turks, or somebody wanted to intervene way back when it started, it was much easier. You had local Syrians demonstrating peacefully to either reform or to change their government, following what happened in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya and other places. That was an easy battle to choose your sides. Since then, it's become far more complicated. And one of the problems that the U.S. and Western countries have had is they wanted to support the rebels, but they were afraid that if you support the rebels, some of the support you give, guns and things, might go to Islamist groups, some of whom are linked to Qaeda, and therefore it's become really impossible to figure out how do you intervene. Mm-hmm. And the consequences of that, though, are that the Qaeda-type Islamist militant groups, terrorist groups, many of them, have become much stronger because they only thrive in situations of chaos. If you look around the world, where did Qaeda and these kinds of Salafist militant groups thrive? Pakistan border region, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq after the American invasion.
Kind of failed states.
Yeah, failed states or states where there's no central government. And now Syria is joining that that list. So it's a really very, very difficult situation. But as I made it clear in my New York Times piece today, that the solution, because it's a proxy war, has become a global and regional proxy war, the solution is going to have to come mostly from those external players. And the four critical ones are the U.S., Russia, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. Until those four get together and decide that the pain that they're suffering and the setbacks to their national interests are greater than any gains they're getting, until that point, nothing's going to happen. But when they reach that point and they feel that the pain is too much for them, they will then get together at some level, maybe not formally, but informally, and wind down the war and figure out how to make a political transition to a new era in Syria.
Well, it does raise questions about this, what appears to be kind of a frosty relationship between Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama. trauma. I don't know how that complicates matters.
Yeah, but this isn't, you know, this isn't Valentine's Day. I mean, this is, you know, the hardball. These guys, they don't particularly need to be happy campers. They need to make a political deal that serves their national interest. Mm. In the final analysis, it's the national interest of every country that counts. And what you saw with the chemical weapons agreement on Syria was the Russians and the Americans both gaining from that agreement, and therefore they did it. And you saw how the local parties had to comply immediately. They had no choice. So that's what I'm saying. If you get the U.S., Russia, Iran, and Saudi Arabia agreeing on some general direction of policy in Syria or some resolution or winding down of the fighting, the local parties will have to go along with it. And this is, I think, the only way to wind it down.
And what about Assad? What I mean, under this scenario, is he a player? Is he find a place to live in Russia somewhere? Or what happens to him?
Well, there's different options. My guess is that we will see a post-Assad transition in 2014. It's likely to happen in a manner that allows him to finish his current term. So he can then say he resisted the rebels, he fought back, he stood his ground, he protected his country. Of course, he didn't. He ruined the country. But he can say that he served his term, and then he'll step down, and then we'll see what happens after that. It has to be negotiated. You can't tell right now. There's no possibility of a negotiated transition right now with the different parties fighting each other. But my guess is that there will be a transition to a post-Assad regime. He can stay in the country like Ali Abdullah Saleh in Yemen. He stepped down and stayed in the country, kept his money, kept his connections. Assad might do the same, or he might decide to go to another country. That's not a big issue.
You know, I have to say, and NPR has been doing some what I consider to be pretty fabulous reporting from this part of the world, and many of those reports focusing on refugee camps, on people fleeing the fighting, children being separated from their parents. And I have to say, these are just heartbreaking stories. And I know many of these people are fleeing to Lebanon, I mean, to the country that you live in. And one just sort of worries about what happens to these families, what happens to these children. Do they go home? Are they stuck in refugee camps? Do they die of malnutrition or, you know, terrible winters that might come in and really cause serious damage?
Well, a lot of these things happen. All of them happen in different places and for different reasons. In some cases, there's camps that deal with the refugees, like Jordan and Turkey. In Lebanon, there's no camps, but people are dispersed all over the country. There's a lot of assistance to them from all kinds of international and local agencies. But a lot of people are in really, really hard times, and many, many thousands of families have no assistance. They're begging on the streets. There's a range of different conditions and different eventualities that happen. Most of them are bad because just being a refugee is bad. And the only solution to refugeehood really is repatriation, that they must go back home, and they want to go back home. Some of them do go back home. They just find it so hard to live in exile in another country with no money and no support and no schooling and no medical care that they risk the dangers of going back home in a condition of fighting, even with sectarian killings going on. Some of them will say, look, I'd rather go home and die than die as a refugee somewhere else. So it's very difficult. It's heartbreaking. But unfortunately, it's one of the constants of the modern Arab world. And that's one of the things that these uprisings are trying to actually resolve in the final analysis, to end this legacy of modern constant warfare, refugeehood, exile, expulsion, dispersion, dispersal, and all of the terrible things that we've suffered nonstop since the first Arab-Israeli war of 1947-48. But ever since then, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Kuwait, Yemen, Somalia, Algeria, you know, one after the other, all these major Arab countries have suffered either catastrophic civil wars or huge internal stresses leading to refugees, internal displacement, and we see the consequences every day.
I've always wondered of the millions of people who fled Iraq during the Iraq War, how many have come back? I don't know if anyone knows the answer to that question.
Well, probably some refugee agencies have compiled some statistics. My understanding is that many of them have gone back, but not all of them. And when they have gone back, they've often gone back to different places than their original homes because you've had polarization in the country. Mixed neighborhoods are no longer as mixed as they used to be. So Sunni and Shia and Kurds and others have gravitated to places where their own people predominate. Because one of the problems we've had, especially coming out of Iraq, has been the rise of sectarianism and sectarian killings and revenge killings. And this is one of the real big issues that I've raised often in my writings, that the consequences of the Iraq War, the American Anglo-American invasion of Iraq, leaving millions of refugees, and also making Iraq today the single biggest training ground mobilizer and exporter of Salafi Islamic terrorists, the people who are going around now into Syria and other places. Iraq is the home base for this system now, with Qaeda-type groups and many others. And this can be traced back directly to what the Americans and the British did when they attacked Iraq. Of course, Saddam was a terrible man, and yes, it was a terrible regime.
Yes.
But what we have now is far more dangerous to Iraq and to the region.
Because it's so chaotic?
It's so chaotic, it's so violent, and it spreads all over the region. The people in Iraq who are training and mobilizing these terrorist groups and these Salafi groups, and they're now spreading in tens of thousands, in some cases, into Syria, some parts of Lebanon, Yemen. And so this is really a huge threat to everybody. Everybody's worried about this. Now, it will be ultimately contained by the people of the region when they reestablish order and some semblance of credible, legitimate governance and stability. So the people of the region, rather than Barack Obama's drones or Dick Cheney's torture chambers, will solve the problem. It's not going to be what American foreign policy does. It's going to be what people in the region do to create normal, right, decent conditions.
Different from your description of Syria, where it's really the outside forces that will get people hopefully to the table and resolve some of these conflicts.
Well, in the war situation,
yes,
Syria,
exactly,
the war. But if once you can reestablish normal conditions, you have a credible, legitimate government, that will establish order, and then people can take control of their own lives and their own destiny and drive out these killers like the Salafi Qaeda-like groups that are springing up all over the place.
And that's Rami Khoury, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a syndicated columnist at the Beirut-based English language newspaper called The Daily Star. And joining us in this hour of Radio Times, frankly letting me pick his brain about a whole host of issues and countries in the Middle East that we're talking about. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Very important part of the world, important for us to understand what is going on. Let me get, looks like Kabita from Plymouth Meeting to join us on Radio Times. Kabita, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi. I really just had a comment from the earlier conversation. I just wanted to thank you for reminding us to be humble in the process of creating democracy. I mean, even now, I think the U.S. struggles with, you know, things like the Voting Rights Act that's been gutted, and, you know, immigrants and even formerly incarcerated who don't have complete rights. And I just wanted to thank you for reminding us to be humble, because it takes a lot to create but also sustain democracy.
Kabita, thanks for the call. Anything you want to add to that, Rami?
Well, thanks for Kabita. I mean, that's a very important point. Humility, you know, is an incredibly important ethical value. When you read the Jewish Bible, the New Testament, and the Quran, humility after faith in God and love of God is probably the most common sort of exhortation from the divine, however you see the divine. But humility is a huge ethical value in the Abrahamic faiths, but it's also, I think, a political value that has to be much more clearly embraced. And I think Obama did it when he recognized how to deal with Iran in a productive way, which is to deal with them as equals and not to just threaten them, but to be humble and say, look, they have rights, we have rights. And so this is a really important point.
Kabita, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me segue from that to an obit that you wrote for Anthony Shadid, the New York Times columnist, or writer, reporter who was killed. And you talked about his humility, the uniqueness of his humility as a reporter, and why his humility allowed us to understand the people that he covered.
Right. I think it's really important, particularly in journalism and particularly in foreign reporting, but in any kind of journalism. I think maybe I'm a bit old-fashioned, and I learned my journalism in the United States. I went to Syracuse University, and I practiced here, and I still write for American publications. But humility, I think, is critically important, because the reporter's job is to just go into society and understand what's going on and try to convey it accurately. One of the problems we have today is many people, especially columnists or big-name writers, their egos take over, and they end up trying trying to tell us how the world should be reconfigured, whereas I think people like Anthony and others were successful because they went out and simply tried to convey what was actually happening in the world through the sentiments of ordinary people, recognizing that ultimately, especially in places where the consent of the governed matters, that the sentiments of ordinary people will shape what happens in these societies, politically, culturally, economically, etc.
Let me read something else you wrote about him. You said, whenever I saw him, his most frequent expressions were, oh, really? Or you think so? Or that's really interesting.
Right. He wanted to hear what you had to say. He didn't want to come and tell you. He didn't say, well, I think this is going on. What do you think? He would ask you, what is the importance of this? What do you think is happening in this society? Why do you think this person is interesting or important? So he was constantly asking, probing, trying to get from the people he talked to, whether they were political leaders or ordinary cab drivers or school teachers or whatever, he wanted to hear what was inside their heart and mind. And I think this is really one of the most important roles that journalists play.
Let me see what Joanne from Newtown has to say. Joanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Joanne. Go ahead.
Thank you very much opportunity. I appreciate it.
Sure.
I'm wondering what your guest thinks about the role of women in Middle Eastern countries, particularly those that are Islamic dominated, and whether democratization can do anything to raise the position and rights of women within those societies and countries.
Joanne, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Rami Corey.
Yeah, thank you, Joanne. It's a very common question and a very important issue. I think historically, to be fair, if you go back in time, women in Islamic majority countries had far more rights centuries ago than women in Western democracies did in terms of what's the letter of the law. In reality, in modern times, the democratic process in the West has advanced and civil rights and all kinds of legal labor laws, inheritance laws, etc., health laws. And people in the Middle East have regressed in many situations. So you do have a situation in the Middle East, which is very different, by the way, in every country. So in some countries, you have women ministers, you have women, many doctors, lawyers, airplane pilots, etc. But in other countries, women, like Saudi Arabia, they can't drive. Or in some countries, women don't have the vote. But also men don't have the vote in many countries. So there's a wide range of issues, but clearly it is one of the issues that characterizes the constraints on the civil and political rights of citizens. But I wouldn't single out women because the constraints on women are similar to constraints on men as well. And it's really the problem isn't only gender. There are some specific gender issues here and there. But they tend to be more in terms of cultural values of societies rather than an official legal restrictions. The real problem is that the vast majority of citizens, men and women, majorities and minorities, are all constrained by the modern tradition of autocratic, sometimes dictatorial governments. But clearly having women participate more in the labor force, for instance, and in public life is a good thing. And where it happens, you see the good things happen.
We're almost up in a break here, but I'm thinking about those uprisings and the video or the pictures from the streets. Were men and women there calling for democracy, calling for jobs, calling for civil rights?
Very much so, yes. And women sometimes are out in the forefront, sometimes they're in the background. But there's that moment of citizen effervescence in December and January of 2010-2011 was one in which religion, gender, other things really were put aside, mm-hmm. and citizens emerged as the driving force.
And again, that's Rami Khoury, our guest today on Radio Times, a syndicated columnist. He writes for the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, and we're talking about a whole host of issues related to the Middle East, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Roadside Attractions All Is Lost, an adventure film from J.C. Shander, Academy Award-nominated writer of Margin Call, starring Robert Redford and with music by Alexander Ebert of Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros, in theaters Friday.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We'll be back to Radio Times in just 1 minute. But first, this reminder about the important role you play as a listener and a supporter of WHYY and Radio Times. Here's that phone number to make a pledge of support, 1-888-345-9499. And of course, you can always pledge online at WHYY.org. Today on the show, an in-depth discussion about the Middle East, a crucial part of the world with enormous challenges and opportunities. Our guest is Beirut journalist Rami Khoury, who has a unique vantage point on some of these events. Also today, Donald Fagan, co-founder of Steely Dan, author of a new memoir called Eminent Hipsters. Where else are you going to hear such diverse back-to-back in-depth interviews? Only on Radio Times. In a time of sound bites and shouted opinions, we offer something different, and that's why you listen. So take that next step and be a supporter. 1-888-345-9499-WHYY.org. Thanks very much.
Tune into NewsWorks tonight, Mondays from 6 to 6:30 p.m. to catch Sky Talk, a weekly discussion of the latest news in astronomy with Dr. Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Made possible in part by Independence Mission Schools.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. If you're just joining us, Rami Khoury is our guest. He's the director of the Issam Faris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. He's also a syndicated columnist at the Beirut-based English-language newspaper, The Daily Star. And we are talking about Iran and Egypt and Iraq and Syria and a whole host of issues related to the Middle East, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get back to our callers, and it looks like we have Ben, who's calling us from Princeton, New Jersey. Ben, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I had a question specifically related to the treatment of minority groups. In Egypt, after the fall of Mubarak, there was a general persecution that still continues to this day of Coptic Christians. I'm wondering how democratization, democracy in general, can help fix something so that seems to be so ingrained between different groups, specifically in Egypt, where, you know, they're really, to be honest, I haven't really heard too much coverage about this, but there's been targeting of Coptic churches. Coptic groups have just been systematically attacked and brutalized continually.
Ben, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Rami Khoury, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Ben. I think you raise a point that has been very much in the news, but I would just slightly differ on how you described it. I don't think this is a systematic, longstanding problem in Egypt. It is a relatively new, short-term issue that it started under the Mubarak regime, where occasionally somebody would bomb a church or attack a church or something like that. And then there's been a few more incidents recently, but this is not systematic. This is not deeply ingrained in society. The much older, deeper, and larger tradition is of Christians and Muslims in Egypt coexisting very happily without any significant problems at all. But you do have now problems where Christians have been targeted. It's not clear who's doing these attacks. Some people say it used to be the government goons under Mubarak who did it. Some people say it's the Salafi, the hardline Islamists. Some people say it's elements of the Muslim Brotherhood. We don't really know who's doing it. It could be external hands trying to stir up problems, but it is happening, and it's happening in other places too. You see it in Syria and in Iraq. So, but it's a bigger problem of sectarian tensions, revenge killings, etc., etc. And it's a problem also that has to do with the breakdown of stability and security in society, and therefore these are easy groups to attack. And there are some extremists among some of the hardline Islamists who don't want Christians in society. They don't want Jews. They don't want Baha'is. They don't want people of different faiths. But these are very, very limited incidents done by a very small group of hardline extremists, and the overwhelming tradition is one of coexistence.
Ben, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We were talking earlier about Egypt, and of course, as we know, the military overthrew Mohamed Morsi. I know you have been critical of his regime, but also, I'm assuming, critical of his overthrow. How do you see the military, and how do you see the country, I guess, going forward? Are we back to a kind of dictatorship, or do you see signs? It seems like you do see signs that there's a movement to create a democracy out of the last couple of months.
Yeah, I think what you see in Egypt, and you see it in Tunis as well, but Egypt is more dramatic. You see movement towards democratic transitions, slow, erratic, but clear movement ahead towards a democratic transition with the new constitution, elections, etc. And you also at the same time see regression to the old ways where the military takes over. But if you go back over the last 2 years and 8 months since January 2011, what you see in Egypt is that there are two major forces in the country. The armed forces is one, and they've ruled the country since 1952. Right. So that's what, 63 years or something, yep. 60, 61, 62 years. The armed forces are still ruling Egypt today. And you also have the Muslim Brotherhood, which emerged now in the last year. They were elected, they ran the parliament, they ran the presidency. And they did a terrible job. They were totally incompetent. They showed a combination of buffoonery and thuggery, which is unprecedented and very surprising and disappointing. They weren't able to manage the affairs of the state. They weren't able to create a democratic transition. They weren't able to do anything really at all. And that's one reason why there was this uprising against them, and the army then moved in. But the armed forces also had opportunities to run the country, and they did equally bad. So the two biggest groups in Egypt that have the most trust in society are totally incompetent in governance. And we shouldn't be surprised, because religion and the security forces are designed to do some things very well, but not running countries. What has to happen is the emergence of a more credible group of people who come together in political parties, civil society organization, whatever, and then achieve incumbency through democratic elections and actually run the country efficiently, as you've seen, say, in Turkey happen. And there you have Islamists, and they used to be military people, but the Islamists. And you've had a transition in Turkey to really good governance, economic growth, stability, etc. So Egypt is going to have to do that, but it's going to take a lot of time, some time. It's not going to happen in a year or two. But they've started the process again. And critically, clearly, the majority of Egyptians don't want the army to run the country forever, and they don't want the Muslim Brotherhood. So we have to give them time to come up with the indigenous groups and institutions that can run the country democratically.
Do you think they need a Nelson Mandela, somebody like that who has who represents the kind of values and future that I'm sure people in Egypt want?
Ideally, that would be great, but it just hasn't happened. We haven't seen these kind of figures emerge in Arab societies. I think it's fair to say that the average Egyptian has values that are very similar to Nelson Mandela's. If you look at surveys and polling and stuff that's been done that looks at values, Egyptians and people all across the Arab Islamic world have a deep commitment to things like justice, equality, mercy, charity, participation, accountability, etc., etc. They really, really feel these values, but they've never had a chance to actually do them and implement them. The most important thing happening right now in Arab countries, especially Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya soon, is individual Arab citizens coming together in groups to write their own constitution. And what are they grappling with? They're grappling with these big issues: the role of women, the role of minorities, the role of Islam, the role of Arab identity in the state. How do you define Tunis as a country? Is it an Arab Islamic country? People say no, because they're not all Arabs. You have Amazigh, Berbers. Right. They're not all Muslims. You have some Jewish Tunisians, a few Christians here and there. And so these big sticker items of identity, power, sovereignty, legitimacy, accountability, voice, respect, all the building blocks of democratic pluralism are finally being addressed by citizens in the Arab world. And they're showing the best of what they have and trying to create these constitutions.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have Reverend Tim Merrill calling us from Camden, New Jersey. And Tim, nice to have you back on Radio Times.
Nice to hear your voice, Marty.
Thanks very much. I should say to our listeners and to our guests, Tim has been a guest on the show before, but go ahead with your question, Tim.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Mr. Corey how he sees the future relationship between North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. It's, the troubles in the past, and, we're looking at Darfur and Mali and this clash between, these cultures. And I'm wondering, seems to be some nervousness in some conversations I've had about as the Arab states transition, will they have an adversarial relationship with Black Africa, especially along the lines of the Sufis versus the Sunnis and the other Arab sects. So I was wondering what that relationship might look like in the near future.
Tim, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Ronnie.
Thank you, Reverend. I think this is a question that really will have to be debated and sorted out in the process of this constitution writing and creating these new governance systems. The relationships between Arab, predominantly Arab North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa is not one that was ever clearly defined in any sort of public process. So if you ask me, what do Tunisians think of Black South Africans or Sub-Saharan Africans, I tell you, I have no idea, because we've never heard them talk about it. It's never been discussed. It's never been clarified. But you do have tensions in some countries like Sudan, like Mali, like Chad and Egypt, etc., and Libya. So the relationship between them has often been adversarial, but so has the relationship between the Arabs and many other people in the region. So I think, again, we don't want to single out any group. It's interesting, if you look at the questions we've had, women, Christians,
yes,
minorities,
yes.
And it's always about groups in the region that have had problems in the Arab world. And it's absolutely correct to point out these problems. But the reality is that the majority of Sunni Muslim Arabs have also had problems in their countries. That's why they're making these revolutions, because they've never been treated fairly. They've never been treated decently. They've never experienced the consent of the governed. And therefore, we need to look at any one of these issues, including Sub-Saharan African and their relationship to Arabs and other countries. We have to look at it in a wider context of societies, Arab countries that were dictatorial, autocratic, militarily run by generals, incompetently managed, full of corruption and violence, to the point where the millions of Arabs finally, you know, said, we can't put up with this anymore. And they had these uprisings and revolutions. And the relationships with Sub-Saharan Africa is one of these issues that will be worked out over time, hopefully in a democratic manner. Sudan already gave us an example of where South Sudan democratically seceded.
That's
from
right.
Sudan. And they left, they split, and people did it peacefully because they needed to have their own identity in their own country.
Let me thanks for the call, Tim. Let me see what Michael from, looks like Glassboro, has to say. Michael, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
I have, Mr. Rami, I was wondering, what do you think about, because do you think there's been a schism between what the West defines a democracy with what the rest of the world defines a democracy? Because I think China is a good example showing that democracy is really not a key ingredient for economic growth. And plus, the UN Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, you know, the emerging countries were like, well, our definition of human rights is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Mm. So do you believe there's a misunderstanding between the democratic principle of the West and the rest?
Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Rami Curry, go ahead.
I think there is a situation where democratic experiences in Western countries, first of all, have differed among them. If you look at democracy in Italy, Japan, and Canada, they're very different. So democracy is a system of governance that evolves in different places in different forms. And the reality is that we've had very few democracies in Arab countries. There's more in the developing South. You have places like India and Indonesia and Malaysia and others that have been democratic. So we can start to see that every country will have a democratic system that suits its own culture, values, traditions, etc. But I think democracy, interestingly enough, was not a big sticker item in the Arab uprisings. You know, when you go back to Tahrir Square, go back and look at those people and the signs they were holding up. They didn't hold up signs saying, I want democracy. They said, I want dignity. I want social justice. I want jobs. I want to be free. I want to live. I want to be a human being. I want to be a citizen. They talked in these abstract generalities.
Is that democracy, though?
Well, I think all of these are elements of democratic life. So in a sense, it's the same thing. But the word democracy is a very narrow definition of how power is exercised. And what people are looking at is something wider that allows them also to define their national values, et cetera, et cetera.
Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me ask you about Libya. And it's how you see that country's moving, I guess, towards democracy now that its leader was deposed and killed. And how do you see the future of that country?
Libya offers some very special challenges. For instance, the country has a small population with potentially huge income from oil, so it has tremendous developmental opportunities. But also, the country was so badly managed under Gaddafi, who was there for 42 years, and who exercised a combination of despotism and buffoonery that was really unprecedented in modern Arab life. And people in the Arab world, you know, thought he was a joke, but he was a bad joke. So the other problem in Libya is that you have geographical differences in the country among Benghazi in the east, Tripoli in the west, and the southern region, where cultures and identities are very different. And these people never had a say in creating a country called Libya, and they being citizens of Libya. This was not something that voters voted on. It was imposed on them by the colonial period. So the question about regional identities is a big one in Libya, and they're really grappling with this now, and it'll take them probably 5-6 months to get to the point where they finish the constitution and address these issues. Mm-hmm. So there are particularly challenges of tribal identity, militarism, regional identity that are bigger than in other countries.
You had mentioned oil. We have only a minute here, and I regret that I'm raising this at the very end. But I've heard people say, and they've said it on the show, that having so much oil in this part of the world has created perhaps more problems than it's solved. It's certainly economically. Do you see it that way?
I wouldn't go that far and make it that simplistic a statement. I would say that oil has created some special tensions and particularly external interventions that have complicated things and created disparities, corruption, mismanagement. So oil should be a blessing. I mean, the income from oil is extraordinary, oil and gas, and there's trillions and trillions of dollars that the Arabs could use. Some of them have used it better than others, but it's really a question of how this resource is managed. So I think intrinsically, I wouldn't say oil has been a problem, but I think the combination of oil, external intervention, autocratic government together has been really quite catastrophic, which is why you have these revolutions.
Well, on that note, Rami Khoury, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Time, syndicated columnist at the Beirut-based English language newspaper, The Daily Star, and again, speaking tonight at 6:30 at Villanova University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Do stay with us for the second hour. We'll be right back.